our tradition.
If you go to Vedanta, I didn't know what the Vedic traditions were because we were, Sudanese in the sense that took over the administration as taught to us by the British. When I came into the service in 1939, I believe, there were British government agents over me, the British chief secretary, and all, but they were not giving us any kind of what is called orientation lectures when we started. The traditions that were perhaps we copied or we borrowed or we took over were all traditions of loyalty and good government and respect for law and order and loyalty to the government you serve and high sense of integrity. Which is one of the greatest things that I really had taken. Now there is also integrity of the public service.
Who were the officers directly above you in Goa and Matra?
I had a man called Rogerson as a government agent in Goa. In Matra there was a local man, Mr. Daniel, who was a burger, civil servant. And then when I came to Colombo, settlement department, we had to take exams. Later he was
Now Rogerson, for instance, did you find him approachable as a cadet?
Yes, he took a lot of interest as a cadet too. I found out of taking greater interest those days in the well-being of young cadets than what the present government agents would find the time to do. I'll come and find out.
I was wondering about Rogerson's attitude to the self-government laws, whether and serving under the Sionist minister.
I don't think Rogerson stayed on till 48. He retired and went off before that. But then I remember I was working also with a man called Langtry in Trincomalee during the war. He was rather, I would say, very strong kind of imperialist. But even they were raising things, so even they did not have. Yes, Ceylon did not do the something that some other countries did at independence. Now, Burma, for example, got rid of the entire British civil service almost overnight and took over the management themselves. I think which perhaps created a lot of difficulties for them at the beginning. Ceylon did not do that. Ceylon allowed all the people who wished to stay on. And did it die. And the last man went away quite recently, Mendes or somebody. So that the British civil servants did not find it. Some of the younger people who could get jobs elsewhere in the empire, there were still colonial situations where they could go, they went away one by one to Africa and West Indies and whatnot. Now the Charenison, who was also in Trincomalee later, I believe went and later became Sir Patrick Renison in Kenya or something and handled this during the Kikuyu movement. But
what sort of chap was he?
Very good. Very efficient.
He died
Didn't he? He didn't die old.
No, I mean, I was in England, I know he died. I was so important to meet him.
He was very, very good chap.
Would you say that the tradition was also very authoritative, but at the same time, paternalistic?
I would say that paternalistic is a more correct term. The benevolent despotism of certain type. They had enormous powers. However, the government agent those days was superintendent of police, he was superintendent of prisons. The government agent, he had more or less the power of life and death over many men. He used to be district judge. When we began to sit on the bench and as magistrates, and sometimes additional district judge, and hear cases and that sort of thing. Which one thing gave a lot of good experience about how to a judicial view of things. Another thing was the powers were all concentrated in this individual because the government, the people depended, the people trusted them in their integrity and their sense of fair play. And here a little bit earlier, in the rural areas, particularly in NWNCP and all that, people like old Freeman, they used to just get into a block cut and go on a long circuit for a month, just to get settling all their disputes. Other than criminal cases of murder or house breaking and things, every little dispute that arose, even they are settled by just inquiring and say, you do this, you do that, don't quarrel about this matter, and they took the advice. That is a very different type of society they handled.
Around the 30s and 40s, with reference to both senior Ceylonese and senior British civil servants, what was the attitude to the state councillors and politicians?
The state council system was a very peculiar one, no? There were no ministers as such. There were a board of ministers and executive committee, and executive committee consisting of all the people in the council share responsibility in some form or in the government, so that they all belong to these committees. Committee decided the situation, and there were no permanent secretaries at that time. Heads of departments had power coming to them direct from the ministers. Ministers were there, the board, they decided the policy. And I think the situation allowed for a greater amount of authority for the heads of departments.
Yes, but not in the local situation, say in Anuradhapura, Mathura, or Goa, what was the attitude of GAs, the minister, councillors, or the MP for the area? Did they kind of treat them as with some sort of disdain?
No, I don't think so. By and large, they were very educated and democratic people. They might perhaps might not tell the same amount of patience that the present day government agent or state department has to exercise in dealing with members of parliament or local politicians. They could get away with a lot more power by even brushing aside, but they dare not do that. They were used to a system, you see, with tradition, but the British tradition which they brought with them when they came was the years and years of democratic government.
But isn't it a practice sometimes? Well, shall I put it in this way? If a local MP now makes a representation, that is generally treated with delicate mark. But in those days, I was wondering whether, even if there was no disdain, these were given a secondary position.
I know there weren't so many complaints over this. Gandhi had always a good respect for the local politicians.
What about the independence vis-a-vis the secretariat? Did you find some of imperious types? Perhaps a very good reason, because of local knowledge, going against an order from Colombo and quite subtly taking an independent path.
I don't know whether that sort of thing came in the earlier days, where a government agent would even perhaps not carry out a directive from his chief secretary or something. But they were very disciplined people. I don't think it arose I mean, to that point. And well, their discipline was so strong, the chief secretary could get rid of a man very, very quick. If a chief secretary could just complain about a government agent to another European, to the governor, and the governor would then complain to the whatever
secretary
of state for colony, the man is just removed. Find people just disappearing and he might be appointed some other colony or taken back home or something.
But to what extent did these senior government agents, especially the Europeans, know the district, or shall I say know the needs and aspirations of the villages?
Well, they depended a good deal on the local chieftains. And they did not bother to learn the language, most of them. And even if they knew, I mean, they would not talk directly to the people in the villages, and all the Karapan area was all there, the Kachari Mudaliyar and the Mudaliyars of the area also very powerful individuals. Because of that, I don't think they had a chance maybe of knowing the village intimately. Other than a few people like Freeman or people went out of their way to meet the villagers, talk their language and visit their homes, there were types that depended for everything on the Mudaliyars and their views. With the result that a good deal of bureaucratic attitudes they are made. You can't deny that fact.
Mm-hmm. What sort of chap was Freeman? I was wondering whether he was a bit naive sometimes.
Well, when I came to know Freeman in Anuradhapura, he had retired and he was living there. He had even lost his seat in Parliament and he was given up. Extremely interesting man. Very simple. He still loved to go with us whenever we went on circuit. He used to say, take me also, and he go to the village and keep on talking to the people while we do our inquiries. And it was a very simple life. But I suppose he just wouldn't become one of the people. But he tried his best. And the fact that he won a seat and was elected to the state council from that province showed that he was a popular man.
His point about the headman is very interesting. Couldn't they really distort the execution of policy, distort the information, build their own mistakes?
They couldn't, I suppose they didn't really. That's why the system was abolished, I mean, long ago. The DRO system was brought in long before the legitimate system was abolished.
On the other hand, well, I don't suppose even the best government agents knew much about the aspirations of the people simply because of the language mediums being different.
Language medium, all the aspirations, the people also were... the people did not have a voice in the sense, no? They had their village committee, but I mean, this situation of universal franchise and electing politicians discussing this in parliament, and the man, the people being represented in a bigger way than the representation of the bureaucrat looking after their interests, that was a situation that came into being only after 1931. And even then the state council days, it was not, it was just developing. But I must say that those people contributed their share in developing it, conducting elections correct and running the government in the way the state council wanted. But I don't think a single government agent, even the Europeans who were here, put the government down that way. We had people like Hudson, Dyson, people whom I know, Peter Langtry, Edison, Mendes, very good people.
Knowing the district, a feature of the, shall I say, the pre-1920s even, was before the car came, was that they had to live in the district, you know, when they go out on circuit and quite often stay out. But I do think that prevailed to some extent even till the early 1940s, and it was only with improving communications and above all G, that people have been able to get to a point quickly. So I was wondering whether that fact, the fact that they had to stay in a village, meant that they got to know more than some of our GAs and AGAs today.
In a way, but then the amount you could do by going to villages that way was very limited. And you could perhaps go to a village and understand that village very well by staying a week there. How many villages can you visit like that? A slow movement. In a year, you might not be today, a man goes, I mean, a jeep maybe attends to 10 different things starting from morning and evening. The speed, the pace of person, the administration is such that, that intimate, this thing. Actually, understanding problems is also a matter of the individual's attitude. You can understand a problem much quicker today than in those days. People are more vocal, they know exactly what they want, and they have no fear of the official to come and say what they want to say.
Yes, in those days, GA had so much of an aura of power that there was this...
There was a big barrier. In that the man had to go to a petition drawer and get a long rank and draw the bring of the petition. Petition is submitted, they are bending two or three and cringing, worshipping and saying how the rule may end, and wait for the words of wisdom, decision to fall, and you dare not argue his case. If you try to argue, the Mudaliar or somebody will shout him down and say, you should not talk like that to the government agent, and that... I think it's all gone now.
No, I was wondering whether staying in the village meant that you are seeping in, you know, some empathy and some understanding, which may not arise from the present
quickly. Yeah, but that doesn't it also develop this paternalistic attitude? When you come to know them very well and you feel that I am looking up to you like a demigod, come there to settle your problems and sort of thing, you begin to get sort of false ideas of some kind. In the settlement department meeting and even the village in the sense that we camp out in the village. We carry our all the tents and everything and settle there because you just can't go every day and do their job. You have to be there in the village to understand all their, because from morning till evening you investigate their problems, their claims, and in the evening you sometimes get told of some old man and sometimes go into things that don't come out in inquiry. It is very much easier to learn that way. Their understanding in the village was far more important than this settling up. Minor disputes about land or something.
But then it is pretty clear that in those days the civil service was not as closely identified with the people as it is today.
This is what I recommend you do.
You don't feel it's
something. What will the administration cannot be identified so much because it has to remain a little bit aloof. for purpose of good administration, I feel, and I may be old-fashioned in this, that the administrator has to be somewhat aloof from the administration that he does. Now, for example, I have what, nearly 100,000 teachers. You must take objective view because every point is, you can't make exceptions in this case. One exception should try to make for an individual is to feel all of the sympathy. Might mean 1,000 people are in the same category. The aloofness is becomes very, very necessary. And sometimes even at the rare time, feeling going against your own, what is called innate sense of there is something that cries for interest. You have to still say that you take a make up there of a hard-hearted attitude and say, well, the teacher task us and they say, we just can't.
Yes, but what I mean was by identification was that to some extent now the intake into the public service is more from a wider strata. And again, purely Iranian and not European. And I think more importantly there, our society is more democratized and there is far more mass influence on administration. To that sense, don't you think
that the identification, by identification you mean that the man, he belongs to the people himself and therefore he is one of them and he knows what their needs are, what their aspirations are. That means true that they come from the masses and therefore they work with the masses and they know what to do. But even those days, I mean, there's actually a feeling that is perhaps mostly newspaper creation. And the whole civil service, as the entire old civil service came from Colombo. And some of the big schools is not true. In the old, I don't know about the very, very ancient days when there were only one or two schools in Colombo and Jaffna which produced the people who could enter the civil service. Later now, it is true we had Colombo education. But my home is in a village and by the time I came to Colombo, so I haven't forgotten the village or you can't say that we are or the products of the Colombo civilization.
Now, that's colonized.
No, I'm from Baduk.
Where was your education, if I may ask?
Well, my first 12 years I was in village school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to Colombo and went to the, what is called secondary education here and entered the university from Ananda. And Ananda also was a school to which all the people from the whole country came.
Mm-hmm.
Not exclusive in any form, but in conglomeration of even the entire country.
From your generation, if I may say so, your generation of civil servants, can you give me other instances of those with a typically rural background?
Well, my batch, take for example, Mr. Dayaradana, who is now Secretary of the Cabinet. He comes from Londra. And he was educated in Paul and later in Colombo. Then Mr. Eo Hira Singh, I suppose, is from Patrikam or someplace. And then I suppose he came to St. Joseph's. Then there were Mr. Eon Ratna from Banadu, he retired. The Janet who came from some place and he have been troubled. The J.L. Dipanand, who in nomination of the Secretary of the Ministry of Agriculture, he came from, I don't know where. So like that they are. Now I don't think in that batch, one chap who could be considered as from a purely urban upbringing.
But is it correct to say that your background is largely Westernized?
Well, at that time, background had to be somewhat Westernized in that you were English educated. The medium of education was English. You studied more about England and English literature and all that than about Ceylon as English literature. Other than a few of us who selected in the university for Indian languages and therefore changed our attitudes by studying Pali and Sanskrit and English.
Those were your subjects, right?
Those were my subjects. Others who did classics or science subjects. I mean, they had no clue about understanding about Ceylon.
In your case, did this westernized, semi-westernized in your case, background mean that there was a kind of a cultural gap between you and the village?
A cultural gap, I don't think arose in my case, but I was lucky because I never was stuck with my home. Being here around one thing, always go there and even now I go. And I kept in contact, but quite apart from that, the fact that we came from the village and then had this westernized education in Colombo for a short period and then went to England and studied there also and came across at the particular in the 30s when this independence movements for India and Ceylon and these countries were very, very vehement. He was a being of a more patriotism which perhaps present-day people don't get. So we were brought up in a period of these struggles, and we were in the thick of it. I mean, we were following, for example, the Russian Revolution very closely. So that was only a few years old at the time. 1930s, only 15 years old. So I think that, I mean, we were always in touch with. Today, perhaps the students don't get that that particular, I would say, atmosphere in there. Far more settled. We want to look at two world wars, you see, during our career.
With reference to fellow civil servants with a distinct urban and western background, did you feel that there was cultural gap and they couldn't grasp some of these rural demands? And
I don't know. If a government agent, I mean, if a government servant, a civil servant, was put through the normal mill of transfers and service expectations that they entitled to have, both the government servant as well as the government entitled to have a certain amount of training and experience of an officer, if that was given, he did not take time to establish himself in that particular way. So there are some very few people, due to circumstances, never went out to the country. From the time they were appointed, might have worked in Palambu and got from one department to the other within the city, and they have never had a chance of working. You see, a wonderful experience for any government service working in a kachari. 2-3 years or longer the better of that experience for an settlement department or things like that, where you work with the people, the villagers' problems, their types of land problems or living problems or whatever it is, trying to work with them and try to help them in whatever the government policy that you are supposed to implement. It gives an understanding which is any intelligent man can identify himself with, if he got any sense of what is called loyalty or patriotism or something.
That's very interesting, because you know, I ask myself that question because I am urban and westernized, and I know I'm aware of the criticism of civil servants, and therefore just have a problem. I sort of have a tendency to challenge this point of view. You know, I wonder if I am put out in the village and want to make a job of it, whether it's impossible to get at the thought processes of the village.
I don't think it is such a difficult thing. Not only not difficult, I think you get it with natural, because you go more or less feel sympathy, much more than looking at it from here. I mean, even a town man, I don't see some sympathy. But it is superficial attitudes he may have with never knowing what the village's life is. That's why even today our department, education department program of work experience and these things, we want to move the Kalambu children into a pedigree for a change. Even the little 2-3 hours he spends there in the sun with the villagers and doing for that little period what he is supposed to go to his whole life, give a new orientation. These are not very strange experiences. This is an urban thing, I think, the fellows are. Most newspaper people who have never lived in the country, they are the fellows who are Western oriented and educated and living in Colombo, and or maybe Peach Street and come back to Colombo again. They travel by car, some trouble spot with the people, big people, and go around, and they don't study the country as anyway as a government servant.
One of the dangers with this process of democratization and this close fewer barriers between civil servants and the people is the possibility that integrity suffers, you know what I mean? In the sense that people might have personal interests. And there are political pressures. What can one do to minimize these dangers?
What can one do? Political pressures are, actually political pressures, when you come to think of it, are things which we have got to understand. Mm-hmm. Before you feel, get angry or start resisting, understand the pressures that are there on the politician. He fights an election and wins a majority in the area, maybe a very small majority perhaps. Half the people are against him, half are with him. And if he is a politician who takes politics as a career, he must go back to them and win the next election also. And naturally he has to do something for the area. And the people who supported him will expect certain things. Helping his son to get a job or get a bit of land for himself or help him in a difficulty. something or other. If the man rushes to the man who comes to help him during the election campaign, there is a supporter. Opponent also feels that if he doesn't go to him, for as a politician thinks, if he helps the man who votes against him, he wins one more supporter. And therefore he tries to help the people win the vote for him also. And then goes out. And they bring all this to the government servant. A government servant who has got intelligence would actually explain even to the politician what can be done and what can't be done. And Taishi is best to help in the sense that if he doesn't go break regulations or something or the villager comes with a problem. MP is an intermediary because the villager feels that he can't have direct approach to a top man. And he comes with his MP. Not a situation to get upset about.
No, in fact, I was wondering whether some of the hostility of the newspapermen and politicians to the civil service arises from the fact that some civil servants, or good many perhaps, are a bit far too impatient on this point.
Well, you can't help sometimes, you know, the pressures that come. Sometimes, I mean, maybe some MPs are different from the others. I mean, you press a certain thing which you know you can't do. You have to say it can't be done. Then he makes it go away and perhaps abuse you in parliament or something and say these bureaucrats and because you can't understand, but cases do happen, but we can't help it. I don't think sensible MPs behave that way.
In your experience, sir, have you found that MPs, for instance, don't themselves show much sympathy to the civil servant? And for instance, take into account the mere fact that he has a lot of work on his hands and is very busy.
I don't know, you always got to find, I mean, that you do the job today in the person context adequately. You have to find patience and the time to meet the MPs and they come and discuss matters with you. Try your best to explain why a certain thing can't be done, or if it can be done, this is the only way it can be done, then try to tell you a man to wait for some time more, come at the correct time more, correct moment or something. I mean, giving jobs for example. There are certain rules and regulations governing these things. You can't take a man just because the MP brings a man along. Getting a transfer to a teacher, for example, there are certain transfers you can do and certain things you can't do. And the explanation is given adequately and it's just. And I personally don't have any. I have come across difficulties with the members of parliament that way.
And on the other hand, do you feel that sometimes the MPs are too gullible in the sense that they are, some chaps are always taking the constituents' word instead of using some sort of judgment?
That I think is true in some cases, particularly the MPs who have not much experience in politics and all that. They don't try to understand the difficulties of the government servant. And if a man comes along and expects everything he brings up to be attended to, and he satisfies every individual he brings, I mean, that's a difficult situation. But fortunately, we don't come across any of this.
And anyway, I would argue that there is definitely a sphere where the MP can exercise legitimate influence. I mean, he is a representative of the people and.
So the MPs, when they pay with the government servant, they go to the minister. And if it is a party MP and the minister, then the minister is certainly obliged to disagree and say, well, this man got a thing to be done and I was trying to be doing it. And then the minister will discuss the matter with his officials and they can't do something about this. And very often, even simple things like he just asked for something which we say we are able to do, the minister might say, well, it must be done. And then you say, well, find a way somehow it can be done. But still, I don't think no minister will ever advise the government secretary or the department director to break rules and regulations. And so he has got to show that there is infinite recruitment. There are schemes of recruitment approved by the Public Commission. And the department just can't violate those. But when MP or minister may say,
I was wondering whether some of our ministers, especially those who lack experience, were prone sometimes to take an MP at their word, at his word, and send an order down without asking for a report.
Then those are cases where the head of department or government secretary gets an order, he's bound to go and discuss the matter with the minister. And then the minister will always say, yes, that is to your right and it can't be done. Then you send a decent, nice report to the MP and explain the case. It is being, you know, perhaps be gruff with him and or try to just brush aside any kind of just because an MP brings something or other. things are created equal. People go to the MP and the government server. And that man then will have eternal grievance against not the individual but the entire service. The type of, there are obnoxious type of parliamentarians, sometimes who just go about trying to throw their weight about and antagonize for the entire public service. And they all know, I mean, certainly, they know that he is a difficult man, other people are much very sensible people.
Public servants, no.
Ministers also know which MPs are reasonable and which MPs are not.
No, what I mean is the problem with public service is when the minister is unreasonable to
Well, I suppose those are the cases where these clashes occur once in a way between the government and the minister, or the private sector and the minister in such cases. Mm-hmm. But fortunately for us, I suppose those are a few and far between, so that by and large administration goes on smooth.
But I think sometimes now political interference has been irresponsible in some spheres, like for instance around 56 and even afterwards, with reference to encroachments. Some MPs went around, encroachments and pain is some sort of the LDO. I think MPs said that need a page and they openly proclaimed. Wouldn't you class that as irresponsible
behavior? Yeah, that is definitely, that is so, I don't know, I have no personal experience of that. Those are the cases that will create difficulties both for the minister and for the bureaucracy. Because well, those are things where they should take up in the first instance with the parliamentary group and get their minister to come to a policy decision and then maybe a cabinet decision. In which case, of course, the cabinet decision is binding upon the entire government. All public servants, everybody, they got to carry out the decision together.
The last bit of the interview could not be recorded because of interference from the other track, and therefore it was hard, too difficult to understand. Therefore, I stopped recording at this point. End of interview with M.J. Pereira on the 25th of September, 1967. Thank you.